From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, parapsychology. Here's what's happening. At least 9 people have died, more than 250 injured, after a powerful earthquake hit southern Japan, toppling buildings and cutting power supplies. Officials say more people could be trapped under collapsed buildings. Thousands fled their homes, and many people spent the night in the open. Troops have been sent to the scene. Rescue operations are being disrupted by aftershocks. It's a mess. No tsunami warning was issued. It was a magnitude 6.4 quake. Let's check in with Stan Dale. Stan, of course, is an expert research physicist, noted author, and he knows earthquakes. Stan, what do you see with your charts? Anything else out there?
Well, you know, I've been looking at the live feed here before we went on air tonight. The 6.2, they've downgraded that one over in Mashika in Japan. Okay. But another one has just hit over in Vanuatu, a 6.4. Now, those two are on different sides of the equator, just kind of underneath each other, or Vanuatu underneath the Japanese one. And there were a lot of aftershocks in this Japanese quake, like about 16 of them since it happened. It's almost like if you visualize a rubber diaphragm over a drum head and you smack it in the middle with a big baton or something so that it vibrates up and down, wop, 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 like that. This is releasing a lot of energy over a lot of quakes rather than all at once, which is good for what's happening over there. I did find it interesting, just as a side note, that when they were rescuing or evacuating the people in Japan, about 45,000 people were evacuated. They had soldiers handing out blankets and adult diapers. Can you get that? Because they didn't have running water for hygiene, so they could use diapers. They didn't even have porta potties or anything. The things you don't think about, you know. Anyway,
Jeez.
Now, what I see is the west coast or the west side of the Ring of Fire is active at the moment. In the last week, we've had about 5 Richter 6 or better earthquakes, obviously the two in Japan just now, Vanuatu, Afghanistan, and Burma. And it's moving to the west toward Europe, all the release of pressure there. But I tell you, we ought to look out over on our west coast, too. Within the next 2 days, I think we'll see an increase in smaller quakes. I don't anticipate a big one right now, but smaller quakes, yes. So, you know, sleep tight over there, but
what about the west coast here of the United States, Stan? Do you see any possibilities here?
Well, Southern California seemed to be a little bit shaky at the moment over the last 24 hours, but they're small quakes, and it might just be normal release of pressure. I don't see a major threat on what I've got at the moment, but again, you know, I have an error, of about 50% in this old method of earthquake prediction.
Oh, but it works. Stan's website, of course, is his name, StanDeyo.com. Stan, thank you so much. In another embarrassing setback for the North Korean regime, a senior U.S. defense official says that North Korea's test, a new one, of a new intermediate-range ballistic missile failed spectacularly. It blew up on the launch, he said. It's an amazing story. The U.S. Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, is currently visiting the Philippines to finalize plans to station U.S. troops there for the first time since 1992. Central bankers usually worry about when to remove the punch bowl of cheap finance, but when they gather in Washington, D.C. this week, they will face a different problem: how to force the world to borrow. For example, in the U.S. households, they're paying down mortgages instead of borrowing against homes to fund consumption, altering behavior that helped fuel the 2007 financial crisis, but also contributed to economic growth as well. A Chicago Federal Reserve Bank composite of bank and corporate leverage has been below average for nearly 4 years. Catherine Austin Fitz, publisher of the Solari Report, with us. Catherine, is this a good thing that people really don't want to borrow right now?
George, we have borrowed ourselves into oblivion. The name of our first quarter wrap-up last year was Planet Debt. The whole planet is so over-leveraged, and if you look at what's happening to the economy, we need to move to an equity model. And the one place that's growing in terms of bank debt globally is the commodity producers, particularly the countries that produce commodities, are having to borrow more, but that's to make up for the deficit as their revenues have plunged with commodity prices. If you look at the big flows in the economy right now, they're flowing into venture capital. It's equity, because equity is what finances the new technology and productivity. That's where the action is. But I just think we're choking, whether anything from student debt to sovereign government debt, we're choking on debt. We've had enough of debt already, and I think Americans are in a, you know, they're in a real hole. And if you look at how much money they're making on their savings, they might as well pay off their debt. It doesn't make sense to leave your money in a, you know, in a brokerage account that's making very little or losing money when you can just pay off your debt, even if it's only 3 or 4%.
Catherine, what are you feeling these days about the economy? Are you bullish? Are you not? What are you feeling?
Well, I'm telling you what I'm bullish on. I'm bullish because I see more people looking at the official reality and saying, you know, we've had it. It's very interesting. I was just writing a comment on the campaign, and you realize we have two contenders over 70, and both of these guys have just had the courage to break with the official reality, and they're basically saying, you know, enough already. Can we talk about the real problems? So that, I think that's very inspiring. There was a great moment in the campaign when Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, came out with a great ad campaign. He said, you know, it's not the choices we make every 4 years, it's the choices we make every day. And if you look at what consumers are doing, you know, consumers have forced Mars and General Mills and all these companies to do GMO labeling that we could never get done in the political process, although Vermont has finally voted for it. So, you know, consumers are beginning, you know, people are beginning to realize, wait a minute, you know, we have the power to change things in very positive ways, and I think that's very hopeful.
By the way, I was in Cincinnati last weekend at an event, and so many people came up to me complimenting you on your performance here on Coast to Coast. So I just wanted to know that.
You trained me, George.
And it didn't take much work, let me tell you. Thanks, Catherine. Catherine's website, of course, will be part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. An Ohio man whose family advertised his need for a kidney in the rear window of his SUV last year has found a donor. He's 68 years old. He received a new kidney at the Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center after suffering with kidney disease for the last 7 years. He was on dialysis. He said that a central Ohio woman called about 4 months ago saying she saw the message on his car. She wanted to help. She cleared all the requirements and got her kidney. It's an amazing story. A story in the news at coasttocoastam.com. A Houston man staying at one of the nation's most famous haunted hotels, the Stanley Hotel, captured a creepy figure in the lobby on video. Go take a look at that story. It really is weird. And a high-tech marine drone scouring the depths of Scotland's Loch Ness for one of nature's most elusive beasts has found a monster, but not the one it was looking for. Rather than the fabled Loch Ness monster itself, the probe discovered, get this, a 30-foot replica used in the 1970 film The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which sank nearly 50 years ago after its buoyant humps were removed. Story we've been talking about over the last couple days, a Russian billionaire is pumping in $100 million in an initiative to find signs of intelligent life in the universe. For the next couple hours, we're going to be talking with our friend Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute, not only about this initiative, but about what SETI's working on. Seth is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, and we're going to have some fun. Seth Shostak is with us. He, of course, is with SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. He is the senior astronomer and director, and here he is back on Coast to Coast as we're going to talk about the search for intelligent life. I love this stuff, Seth. It's exciting.
Well, it is, and there's always something new, George.
That's right. So where did Uri Milner, the Russian, get all this money to spend $100 million to look for intelligent life?
Well, this is his second breakthrough project, actually. Where he got the money, I think you'll have to ask Uri that, but my understanding is he's an investor, and he's invested in companies like, I think, Facebook and Twitter. I'm not absolutely sure, but those are the ones that I seem to recall. And he's been pretty successful investor. He's a very smart guy, and he knows a lot about science, and he wants to encourage science, and he usually does that with big prizes. But, you know, over the course of the last year, he's done something different. Last summer, he put $100 million into SETI, not at the SETI Institute, I have to tell you.
Unfortunately,
yes. It went to the University of California at Berkeley. But the announcement this week was about something else, and that's his project Breakthrough Starshot, where he's hoping to actually go to the stars, or at least send some hardware to the stars.
Now, this initiative, this Breakthrough Starshot that he's trying to do, Stephen Hawking, is he behind this too? What's he behind?
Well, he was certainly part of the press conference for both of these $100 million initiatives, actually. Stephen Hawking, but also the very well-known physicist Freeman Dyson, Carl Sagan's widow, Annie Druyan, there's Pete Warden, former center director at NASA Ames, a whole...
list of people. He got Zuckerberg from Facebook too, didn't he?
Well, Zuckerberg is certainly part of his project. Yeah. Well, I think Zuckerberg is a bit of a pal with Yuri Milner, so he gets involved in some of these things. Mind you, these are not the people that are going to be doing the work in general. It's just to give some heft, I think, to the idea.
And Seth, let me ask you this, because, you know, we have been supporters of SETI since I've been doing this show. I mean, we think the world of you and the organization. Why can't they give a little bit of this to SETI, who is actually out there? You're doing this. You've been doing this. You've got the telescope arrays. Paul Allen donated. Why aren't they boosting that?
Well, you know, George, it's a good question for which I don't have a very good answer. And I think it all has to do with whatever project he thought people could do, with the internal politics of the people he talked with. You're asking me to get into the mind of Yuri Milner, and alas, I can't do that. If I could, maybe I'd have a job as a neurosurgeon or something. But
if we end up getting him on this show, that's one of the questions I'm going to ask him. I'm going to say, you know, Mr. Milner, are you aware that there's this organization that's doing everything you want to do, and all they need is a little more financial backing to go the distance?
Yeah, George, I think he's very much aware because, in fact, I have, met with him many times. He's had me over for breakfast at his house.
Okay.
So it isn't that he's unaware. It's not that he's unaware.
Well, let's work on him.
Okay.
My gosh. And let's talk a little bit about SETI as well, Seth. What's going on there? Give us some updates.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth talking about the Breakthrough Space Shot Initiative, too, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of what it can do. But at SETI, I think that the news, when somebody, asked me, okay, you guys are still listening, anything new there? The new thing is we've started a new two-year program, really. It'll take about 2 years to point our antennas in the direction of some dim stars called red dwarfs. These are the dim bulbs of the galaxy. In fact, they're the dim bulbs of the universe. When it comes to stars, they're smaller stars. They may only be half the diameter of the sun. Some are a little bigger, some are a little smaller, but they're very dim. And we've kind of ignored them in the SETI world ever since SETI began, because for various reasons we figured these were not the places that ET would want to call home. But I think it's time for a change of attitude there, as they say in Philadelphia. Got to change our attitude and take a look at these, and we're planning to look at 20,000 of them over the next 2 years.
That's a lot of stars, Seth.
It is. It's actually, when you think about it, people will occasionally ask me at cocktail parties. I think I've been to 4 in the last 10 years. They'll ask me, how do you explain the fact you haven't picked up a signal yet? And I'll say, well, we haven't looked at that many star systems yet. And so the next question is, well, how many have you looked at? And the answer to that is, a few thousand, if you count those that have been looked at carefully. And a few thousand is a pretty small sample in a galaxy with a few hundred billion stars. So this is at least, an order of magnitude more stars than we have ever looked at in any given project.
When you hear a story of astronomers finding an Earth-like planet out there, way out there, do you turn the array that way and try to listen in?
We do. Now, of course, some of the planets that are found, they're called exoplanets. sounds like, I don't know, tic-tac-toe or something. Exoplanets, we do, in fact, swing the Allen Telescope Array in the direction of these star systems, unless they're so far south that we just can't see them. I mean, you know, about a third of the sky is kind of invisible in the northern hemisphere. But we do. But, and we haven't found anything looking at those things yet. But do keep in mind, you know, you could have pointed antennas in the direction of the Earth for 4.5 billion years and not picked up coast to coast or any other
transmission.
Right. So it doesn't mean too much to look at a few dozen or a few, you know, even a few thousand of such stars.
Now, Yuri Milner's breakthrough Starshot, does that include a lot of radio telescopes and in larger telescopes? What's the plan with that?
Well, the plan there isn't so much to look for intelligent life or do SETI. It's to do something else, something that, I don't know, I think that the zeitgeist of the world is that our future in terms of, you know, humanity's future is eventually to go to the stars. Now, you know, is that realistic? Have they actually, you know, worked out how much energy it takes to go to the stars and all that sort of thing? Nope, but they've seen Star Trek. They've seen the movies. They've seen the TV shows, and doggone it, you know, by the 23rd century, everybody will be wearing spandex and going to the stars and meeting, you know, knobby, four-headed aliens, right? So we just assume that that's possible, but it's very hard. You know, it's thousands and thousands of times farther to the nearest star than it is even to Pluto, and it took our rockets, you know, our fastest rocket, 10 years to get to Pluto. So it would take almost 100,000 years for that rocket to get to the nearest star. Well, Yuri is suggesting, he's funding some studies about how you could get to the nearest star, not in 100,000 years, but maybe in 20 years. But of course, not putting people on the rocket, but putting little chips, little bits of circuitry.
Seth, the mechanism for funding, $100 million, lots of money. Are we sure he's going to fund all this? Or, you know, I hate to say it, but does he just come up with $1 million and then fade away?
Well, I you know, of course you have to wait and see, but I don't think that that's the case. That's not my impression. Yuri will come across with the money. Mind you, do keep in mind, this is not going to build the hardware or the rockets or the little probes that are going to be launched in the direction of Alpha Centauri, which is the nearest other star system.
Which will take a zillion years to get there at our current propulsion rate.
Well, as I say, for our current rockets to go there is just not on. I mean, yeah. You're not going to launch a rocket that spends 100,000 years cruising to the nearest
star. No, not going to happen.
Not going to happen. But he's going to do it in 20 years, as they say, with a kind of a clever propulsion scheme that's better than a rocket, faster, but it can't send very much. Is he going to do it? Yeah, I think he's going to do it, but he's not building it. See, that's the thing. This $100 million, which will probably be spent over the next two decades, is only to get, if you will, the studies done.
Oh, my God.
The design job. After that, somebody's got to come up with a much bigger amount of money to actually build it.
Will he want someone like Elon Musk to get involved?
Well, I mean, that's certainly an idea. I'm sure he's thought of it. But, you know, the first thing to do is figure out, okay, how do you do it from a technological point of view? I mean, the basic idea is already there. People have been thinking about it for a while, and the idea is instead of using a rocket, which will never go fast enough, you know, conventional rocket kind that they launch all the time from Florida, you know, they're just burning lighter fluid. I mean, they're kerosene or whatever. But if you can, in fact, make a rocket that's nothing more than a sail, you know, just a sail in the same way that, I don't know, ships sail, a sail that's out in space, and you hit it with a big laser, I mean a really big laser, well, that causes the sail to accelerate, you know, it reacts, and you can push that sail, you just push it for a couple of minutes, and you could accelerate it up to, he thinks, 20% the speed of light. Now, just to give you some idea how fast that is, you know, our fastest rockets go something like 35,000 miles an hour. You know, that's great if you're going to Kansas City,
mm-hmm.
You know,
that's
but
right.
But this thing will be going 35,000 miles a second. So that's a lot faster.
Yeah, it sure is.
Anyhow, you know, on paper it all works, but you have to build these very, very powerful lasers. I think that's one of the hardest things.
Seth, when we come back in a moment, I want to talk with you about these red dwarfs that you'd like to study and what you think could be there because I always thought a red dwarf was a very hot star and that nothing could exist. So we'll talk about that. And then update us on the Tabby star, where some people suggest there could be an alien megastructure out there. I want you to explain that. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Seth Shostak from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I'm predicting next hour that Bill, the amateur astronomer, will check in. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our friend Seth Shostak with us from the SETI Institute. Seth, give us the scientific verbiage of a red dwarf. What is it?
Well, red dwarfs. You know, stars come in all sizes. I think most people recognize that. There are some that are very big. They're called giants, and there are even such things as red giants and blue giants. They're giant stars. Our sun will become a red giant in about 5 billion years. I wouldn't wait up, but it's going to happen. But most stars are small stars. It's just like animals, really, George. You know, there are some big animals, elephants, tigers, lions. They're the ones everybody wants to see at the zoo. But, of course, there are a lot more small animals than there are big ones. They usually don't put them in the zoo because who wants to go see squirrels or, for that matter, cockroaches? But there are a lot more of them. Now, the same is true with stars. And, in fact, you know, a star like the sun, which is sort of, you know, halfway between big and small, about 8 or maybe 10% of all stars are about the same size as the sun. But 75% of all stars, 3 out of 4, are what are called red dwarfs. They're little dim bulbs of the galaxy, in fact, of the universe. Now, you can say, so what? Well, the so what is kind of twofold. They might be, you know, pretty interesting to look for signs of life because, A, there's so many of them that if you can only look at, a, you know, 10,000, 20,000, then on average, they're going to be closer because there's so many of them. They, you know, the distance to the nearest 20,000 is a lot less than the distance to the nearest 20,000 stars that are like the sun. So that's a good thing. If you're looking at something that's closer, you have a greater chance you might pick up a signal because the signals will be stronger. But the other thing, and this is something that, you know, might not occur to you, these little stars are so small that they don't go through their fuel very quickly. They just burn and burn and burn. They keep shining and shining essentially for 100 billion years. Now, it's only been 14 billion years since the Big Bang, so every red dwarf that ever got turned on is still turned on, is still in their adolescence, they're still young. And that means that these stars, on average, they're billions of years older than the sun. Now, that might be a good thing because if you're going to cook up something intelligent, if you're going to talk about intelligent life, you know, if a star's been around longer, there's been more chance for that to happen.
That's true. Now, do you think, Seth, realistically, that there's a formula here for life in the universe? I remember 13 years ago, you and I were talking, and we talked about the primordial soup, that it's the same all throughout the universe. So if you have the right complexity of, you know, a planet to a star, and you've got water, you know, there may be pretty good chances that you're going to get some kind of life. And how it will develop, who knows, because you need other things to influence that. And, of course, we're putting religion aside for a moment and spirituality, because a lot of people will say, no, it's God that just did that. Well, let's just put that aside. I am a believer, by the way. But in this case, if everything's the same in the universe and you find these complexities all over the place, you know, the Drake equation, of course, which is the basis for SETI, that, you know, there could be a lot of systems out there that support life.
Yeah, well, absolutely, George. That's the assumption. And I have to say, in all honesty, it is still an assumption. I mean, we think that there are a lot of planets that are kind of like the Earth. In other words, they have liquid oceans and an atmosphere and so forth. We don't know how many, but on the basis of work done mostly by NASA's Kepler telescope, the estimates are that maybe 1 in 5, 1 in 10, 1 in 20, let's call it 1 in 10. 1 in 10 stars out there has a planet sort of like the Earth. Well, that's a lot of Earths. I mean, just in the Milky Way, that's tens of billions, maybe 100 billion of them. That's a lot. Now, you know, will any of them have life? Well, it depends on how hard it is to cook up life, actually. And nobody knows whether that's easy or hard. A lot of biologists think it's not terribly hard. Some others think it is. The only way you can answer the question whether it's hard or easy is either to A, find it, which, of course, is, you know, that would be pretty good proof.
Mm-hmm.
Or figure out how it got started here on Earth. If
that's
you find
right.
that process, then you can say, okay, I understand the chemistry of how life got started, so now I understand whether it's likely to happen anywhere else. And we haven't succeeded in either of those, but that probably, well, I'm just guessing now, but I think that that will change in the next 10 or 20 years.
It's safe to assume that life on this planet is relatively young compared to the 4.5 billion years old of the planet. Is that a safe assumption?
No, actually, it's not, because, in fact, the oldest life that we've found on Earth, right, is, I mean, if you're talking intelligent life, you're right, but if you're just talking
intelligent life.
I'm talking about. I mean, Homo sapiens likes to define itself as the only intelligent life. Mind you, the dolphins weren't asked.
Yeah, if they only had thumbs.
Yeah, if only they could write. But, you know, if you're talking Homo sapiens, sure, we're very recent arrivals. But life itself, biology, and now we're talking microbes, but that's been around at least for 3.5 billion of Earth's 4.5 billion years, and probably for at least 0.5 billion years earlier than that.
That's pretty dramatic.
So, yeah, that's an interesting fact, that life got started on Earth almost as quickly as it could. And while that's not proof of anything, it does suggest that it wasn't very hard.
Assuming that we've got millions of Earth-like planets and civilizations out there, just an assumption, can we assume that if there are 1 million years ahead of us or 2 million years ahead of us, that they have survived? Or is it inevitable that life will die out no matter where you are?
Well, in terms of life, you know, it's hard to get rid of life. Anybody who has an infestation of ants in their kitchen knows how hard it is.
They keep coming.
Get rid of life. I mean, you know, a lot of people are worried today about climate change and this is going to, you know, wreck everything. Well, maybe for us, it isn't going to wreck anything for the bacteria. They'll be just happy as they can. I was going to say happy as clams. Maybe the clams will be happy too, but the microbes will really be happy. So getting rid of life is very hard. Earth has had some bad times in the past. There was a time when there was ice on all the oceans all the way down to the equator, but life wasn't wiped out. 66 million years ago, big rock slams into Mexico, wipes out the dinosaurs and 2/3 of everything else, but life wasn't wiped out. Life has never been wiped out, at least in the last 3.5-4 billion years. So life is really tough to get rid of. Getting rid of Homo sapiens, well, I mean, if you want to make a project out of that, you might be able to do it.
Now tell us about the Tabby Star, which was named after Tabitha, the woman who led the team that discovered this thing.
Yes, Tabitha Boyajian. And I'm sure I've mangled her name. But
that's why I let you pronounce it.
I realized that, George. She's at Yale University, and she led a team of people that were investigating some of the data, again, from NASA's Kepler telescope. And she came across this particular star, which is it's KIC 8462852, which is really a difficult name.
So we call it the Tabby Star. It's easier,
yeah,
right?
Sometimes we've called it Bob. But whatever you call it, it's a star that's actually pretty far away. It's 1,500 light years away, roughly. That's pretty far, but when you look at it, and what Kepler did was look at it and just measured how bright it was from minute to minute kind of thing. When you do that, you find that it's, you know, like most stars, its brightness doesn't change. But every now and again, every couple of hundred days, it seemed to suddenly get dimmer, and not just a little dimmer, right? I mean, when sunspots, you know, cross the sun, the sun gets dimmer by maybe one part in 10,000. Yeah, it's very small. But this was a dimming by, you know, 1/4 almost. So that's very strange. And it didn't happen regularly as if there were a planet going in front of this star. So they wrote a paper describing this. And then they had a short laundry list of things that they thought might be causing it. But none of those explanations was very interesting. The whole thing sort of took off when a guy at Penn State by the name of Jason Wright suggested, well, one possible explanation is that there's some super civilization around that star that's built what's called a megastructure, you know, just something big, really big.
The Dyson Sphere, right?
Yeah, exactly, Dyson Sphere. You know, they're collecting a lot of solar energy because they've got, you know, plenty of video games they need to power, whatever it is. And that you know, that Dyson Swarm, whatever, occasionally gets between us and the star and it blocks a lot of the light. Well, that's a much more interesting explanation than any of the sort of natural ones. So that's why this became a big story.
How big would that sphere have to be?
Well, I tell you, the part that blocks the light, since you're talking about 20% of the light from that star, then it has to be roughly, you know, 40% of the diameter of a star, okay? And even more. Maybe,
look, man, I don't care what kind of technology they have. I don't think you can build something like that.
I you know, never say never. But you know, if they're a million years more advanced, maybe they build something. But to give you an idea, the dimensions that you're talking about here are a structure that's, you know, maybe 400, 500,000 miles on a side. Okay, that's pretty big. Of course, you're building it up in orbit where, you know, it's a little easier. You don't have to fight gravity and all that. But that's a big thing. But the real, I mean, that would be very interesting if true. But I think that the first thing to do is to look at the history of astronomy. When something new and puzzling shows up, there are always some people who will say, aliens are doing this. But that's never been the case. It always turns out to be nature. So that's what I figure will happen with this, but it'll take a while.
Seth, have you been with SETI since its inception?
No, I have not, actually. You mentioned the Drake equation. Frank Drake did the first modern SETI experiment back in 1960. The SETI Institute, where I work, was founded in 1984. I was living in Europe at that time. So I've not been there from the beginning, but I've been there, I guess, almost as long as anybody there now.
Even though you're part of the team that is, you know, searching for intelligent life, do you personally believe that it's out there?
Well, of course, George. I mean, I wouldn't keep the job if I didn't think it was some chance.
Well, you know, somebody may say, "Hey, I like the job. I don't believe it. They're out there." But
you haven't tasted the Institute's coffee, have you?
No, yeah, I have not. I have not. So you believe that, but you do not believe that we've been visited here. How come?
No. We discuss this routinely on Code.
Yes, we do. We let you debate Stanton Friedman. Remember that?
I remember it. I'm constantly reminded of it, actually.
Yes, you are.
But, yes, no, I don't think we have. Mind you, that's my opinion, and it's based on, you know, what I see of the controversy. But, you know, if we were being visited, I think maybe I would give up my job at the SETI Institute and go investigate, you know, the evidence here, because that would be remarkably interesting if we were being visited, for sure.
I assume that if they're out there listening like we are, that they may have found us a long time ago.
Well, probably not a long time ago. See, that's an important point. If they have some big antennas, and they would have to have antennas bigger than what we have, but, you know, you could build them, they might be able to pick up, they would be able to pick up some of our transmissions, probably not coast to coast, because that's mostly AM, that doesn't go through the ionosphere very well, but FM radio, television, and mostly radar, they all sail right through the atmosphere here, they go right into space. However, we've only been doing that since the Second World War. So, you know, that's been, 70 years or so. So those earliest signals are only like 70 light years out. Now, 70 light years is a pretty big distance if you're talking about, you know, a hike in the woods. But it's pretty short compared to the distances to most stars. So unless there just happens to be a society that's very close to us, they won't know we're here.
No, I guess they won't.
No. Nope.
And Stephen Hawking kind of thinks that's a good thing.
Well, he has said something about that. It's rather well known that he said, you know, be careful about broadcasting into space because you don't know what's out there, and maybe they'll take offense and they'll just launch their rockets toward Earth and just blow us up. I don't know why the aliens would spend money doing that, but, you know, who knows what aliens want to do. The thing about that is a couple of things. One, Stephen Hawking didn't actually make a long statement about this. He just said, you know, when a less advanced society meets a more advanced society, it doesn't always work out so well for the less advanced. Well, we all know that's true. Anybody who studied, you know, history in middle school knows that's true. But it's also the case, you can do two things. One, anytime Stephen Hawking says anything about anything, of course, it's news, right? My next door neighbor can talk about the poor dry cleaning service he's getting, and nobody cares. But if Stephen Hawking were to say something about it, everybody would care. So there's a certain calibration you have to make there. The second thing is that it's easy to convince yourself that any society that could, you know, come here and wreak havoc and destruction and do terrible things, they could pick up you know, the radars and the FM radio and the television that we just talked about. Because if they have technology that allows them to build rockets that would, you know, come here and do terrible things, they could pick up those signals. So we've already been broadcasting, and when those signals get to them, they'll hear them.
Seth, is SETI listening primarily for transmissions of you know, communications, broadcasting, and things like that?
Well, in a sense, we don't care, right? I mean, if you pick up a signal, who cares whether,
right,
you know, the top 40
it could
or
be
whatever.
Their Coast Guard talking to each other. You
yeah,
don't care.
Exactly. I mean, it's just a radar. You know, they're looking for incoming comets or something like that. That's something that you might well pick up because those are strong signals. And it's not very interesting to listen to, but it tells you somebody's there. And so that's job number one. It's sort of like, I don't know, looking for the red light outside a radio studio. It doesn't tell you much about the programming, but it does tell you they're on the air.
That's a good point. That's a good point. What will you generally, if you pick up something, what would it be like in terms of the format? Would it just come across as, you know, a sound? Would you actually hear their voices if they had them? What will you hear?
Well, unfortunately, in order to hear the voices requires a receiver that's a little different from what we use in SETI. I mean, in SETI, we're trying to find something that's probably a very faint signal. After all, the distances to the stars are quite high. And the other thing is, we don't know where on the dial to tune, right? We didn't get a program guide. So that means we have to listen to, in our case, typically 40 million channels at once, okay? And for each channel, all we do, it's very simple in a way. We simply ask, is there some excess radio energy at that spot on the dial? I mean, of course, there's static everywhere, but is there, you know, more than the normal amount of static? And if there is, then we say, okay, now we found something. It won't tell you what they're saying. Maybe they're presumably saying something. I mean, you know, the signal will have some information on it, because otherwise, why would they build the transmitter? But our current equipment isn't able to find that out. If we found out that they were on the air, if we saw that red light outside the studio, then we would, you know, build a much, much bigger, more sensitive setup to try and find out, okay, what are they sending us?
How much noise, Seth, is out there in the universe?
Well, there's a lot of noise out there. I mean, well, it depends. I mean, I say a lot. I don't know what a lot is, but because the universe is fundamentally pretty quiet in the same way that the universe is fundamentally pretty dark. But there are a lot of, you know, a lot of things that aren't dark in the universe, as you can find out if you step outside anywhere but in a city. You'll notice that. And the same is true if you point an antenna at the sky. You know, most of it is pretty quiet. But there are things like, everybody's heard of them, quasars, pulsars. The sun makes a lot of radio noise. Jupiter makes a lot of radio noise. Cold gas in the universe makes noise. Hot gas makes noise. There are all sorts of things that make radio static. But unlike a transmitter, they make that radio static no matter where you tune the radio. You'll just hear it everywhere. And if you find some transmission that's only at one spot in the dial, you can say, well, I don't know what it is, Bob, but it's a transmitter.
What about Earth-generated interference? Is that out there too?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's all over the place.
That's
a big problem for SETI, because we've got this very sensitive receiving equipment, and of course it receives all sorts of signals, but they're aircraft, they're radars down at the local airport, their telecommunication satellites make a lot of interference. Really, if you had the money, you would put this whole project on the backside of the moon where there isn't any interference to wreck things for you.
Of course, there could already be something there from somebody.
Well, we've looked at the backside of the moon, and what we find are more craters, but, you know.
Hey, let's take some calls with you when we come back. Seth Shostak with us from the SETI Institute, a great institute, by the way, and the website is SETI.org, and Seth has one too, so go to our website and just take a look. We'll be back with your calls on Coast to Coast AM.